All right, so thanks for coming. So this is for the board, school board, and the subject is taking the lead. So first of all, I kind of like to do this with when I'm talking to a group of teachers, just to kind of know how nervous I should be. So how many of you are currently on a school board? How many of you have at some point, you know, been on a school board for 5 or more years? 10 years? Anybody? How long have you been?
Most of my married life.
Okay. How long have you been married? Remember that? That's an important thing to remember. Yeah. So, I do have some time here where, you know, we could have some input. I think most of my points here I am on school board. I've been for a few years now, not terribly many, but probably most of my observations are going to be coming from a teacher's perspective. So, first of all, what is a leader, and what does that mean? So, you think of a leader. I mean, you can have good leaders, you can have bad leaders, you can have poor leaders, great leaders. But a leader is someone who leads by some means, or he takes the lead in something, takes responsibility for something. But what is a great leader? What does it take to be a great leader? So I have a story. I don't think any of you were in earlier session today. Have a story. It's not the same story, but it's maybe a almost parallel story. I told the story this morning of two explorers that were racing to the South Pole. So at that point in the early 1900s, there was just not a whole lot of great places to make a name for yourself anymore, right? So it was basically the North Pole and the South Pole. That's where the races were. Everything, I mean, there's places where, you know, just pretty inhospitable, but as far as a destination to make a name for yourself as an explorer, there just weren't, you know, from there to space, there wasn't a lot of options. Maybe a mountaintop or you can walk or ride or swim or do whatever, however far, but as far as for an explorer, trying to make a name for yourself, it was pretty miserable, right? And the interesting thing about the North Pole is it's not on land, right? So it's in the ocean. It's ice a lot of times, so you can't get there. Really inhospitable. But it's not a place you can go poke a flag in on land, right? It's not. So that's really difficult to say. It's just. As the North Pole. And so it's still debated whether the people that claimed to be to the North Pole first actually made it, because some of the things they said barely line up with reality. But the South Pole that's a real place on land. Still ice, right? But it's ice over land instead of ice over water. Big difference, actually. So it's not going to break up certain times of the year, and you can poke a flag in and. So, there was an explorer by the name of Ernest Shackleton, and he'd been in Antarctica, and I think, and the ones that were racing to the South Pole was Roald Amundsen from Norway and Scott from England. Really interesting story about what happened there. But Shackleton, also from England, trying to make a name for himself, decided, you know what, the South Pole's taken, but nobody has gone the whole way across Antarctica. That's something I might be able to do, and that'll make a name for me. So in 1915, kind of into 1914, he has this plan in mind. I believe the South Pole's reached in 1911, so just a few years later. I believe he had tried an earlier expedition, didn't make it, made some good discoveries, figured out some ways to get through some of the mountains. Because you see, Antarctica here, if you land on this ice shelf, it's an ice shelf. And you have to go way inland and cross mountain range, 10,000 foot mountain range in Antarctica, right? So, and then you're on the land and you're on the plateau and you can go to the South Pole, you know, if you don't die. So he was going to land basically from the South America side, and he was going to go the whole way across Antarctica. But there was no way for him to carry enough provisions for the whole trip, right? So he had learned some lessons from the mistakes that his fellow English explorer Scott made, and he died. He did make it to the South Pole, but it was after Amundsen, and he died on the way back out. And he learned some mistakes from him, learned some good things Amundsen did, and he brought a bunch of good dogs, and they were going to sled across the continent. Skip the ponies Scott tried, and that whole story in itself. So he was prepared, but he had another ship sail from Tasmania with supplies and land on this side of Antarctica, and they'd have to go about one third of the way across the continent to set up a supply depot so that these people coming from this side could stock back up and make it the rest of the way across. So it was a two-pronged approach, and only one team would make it the whole way across. And of course, he's leading that team. But their success, their survival, is completely based on the success of the other team. Right? So he's on his way, and the way a lot of these expeditions work is you have to get there in the summer, right? And then you don't have time for your expedition. You actually have to set up camp for the whole winter, and you have to kind of have a base camp to winter it out, have enough supplies, and then head out the next summer as soon as you can. Okay. But he's on his way in, and early bad weather, miscalculations. He got stuck in the ice, 100 miles from land, basically. So there was really nothing to do. I mean, he's stuck in the ice. He's in the Antarctic ice. And they just simply have to wait for the sea ice to break apart, which would be like a whole winter. And they're in the sea ice. It's not land. And so, you know, you have this buckling, moaning, groaning mass. And he was hoping they might be able to... Well, at this point, he still had the dream, right? So we'll get to that. So they threw off as much weight as they could onto the sea ice. And that was to make the ship lighter so that hopefully the ship wouldn't get crushed by the ice. And hopefully it'd pop out. And over time it would kind of pop out and it would lean over and then it would kind of settle back in. But they stayed in the ship. And, you know, captain didn't just bail out of a ship. They rode them to the bottom. It was usually the end of their career if they had to, you know, and more often than not, their life. But the sea currents moved the ice and therefore the ship further and further from land, and the blizzard set in, and it was just miserable. So this went on for months until it was finally obvious that the ship is going to sink. So they have to come up with another plan. So they abandoned the ship, hopped out, and spent the next month retrieving the supplies off the ship. I mean, just as much as they could, as much as they had the dogs, they had, you know, had lifeboats. They had food. They were well prepared. So if I understand right, in about 281 days, they drifted about 1,200 miles. And not in a straight line, necessarily. And they didn't just stay on the boat the whole time. You know, they got off and did things and ate seals and penguins and kept, you know, didn't eat everything that they had. So they got the lifeboats off the ship, and 10 months after getting stuck, the ship finally sunk. And here they were on the sea ice, just moving. You know, I mean, some of the time it seemed stable, but something, you know, a storm would come along, there'd be waves, it'd break up. And so sometimes their camp would basically break up, and they'd have to move their camp and hope, you know, what happened earlier on a few years back when Scott was trying to go to the South Pole is in one of these breakups, some of his ponies fell into the sea and the killer whales ate them, right? So they kind of wanted to avoid that. And so they'd have to move their camp around to keep on sort of stabilized. And so remember, they're 10 months into it at this point. And finally, they kind of had to deal with all of the dogs that they had along, because dogs eat a lot of dog food. And a lot of dogs eat a really lot of dog food, which happened to be meat. And so they could shoot seals, and, you know, they wanted to eat those too. And finally, they ended up, you know, they were eating too much, and they were also potential food. Right? So they pretty well killed them all. So finally, they kind of figured out where they were by some hiking, pulling stuff, navigating their lifeboats, pulling some. They pull their lifeboats, hook a bunch of guys up to lifeboat, and drag it across the ice. Hard work. I mean, these are 20-foot boats. So nearly 5 months of this, after their ship sank, so after they got off the ship that they were in for 10 months, stuck in the ice, well over a year since they had had their feet on land of some kind. They made it to Elephant Island, which is an uninhabited, desolate island, but they were on ground, right? So, a little brighter, but, you know, I mean, at least the ground wasn't going to sort of give away under them and the killer whales get them. But still, no real rescue is going to happen. And so, I don't know if you can, it's difficult on a flat map versus a round map, right? So when you're looking at this, this is the Ross Sea. This is kind of where they would land. This is where they would try to hit the South Pole. That would basically be about here, right? So they were somewhere, and I'm not actually sure exactly where Elephant Island is here. It doesn't have a label. But it would be, I think, somewhere out in here. And I'm not quite sure. Anyway, I should look that up better. But they made it to a little island. They made it to some land. So, there they are on Elephant Island, right? They can shoot seals and penguins and hunker in. But there's no rescue, right? I mean, people don't just drive by Elephant Island for no reason. And nobody knew what happened to him. So he decided the only way of rescue, the only way he was going to get his men out alive, he'd already abandoned his ship, abandoned his dream, was to get to a small island 750 miles across the worst ocean in the world. So we're talking the Antarctic Ocean, and I believe the island he was headed for was the South Georgia Island. Does that make sense? Yeah. South Georgia Island. This says South Georgia. Yeah. So that's where he decided he had to go. That was the closest. That was the closest place where he thought there would be some people there because they had a whaling station. And that was actually a stop on the way to Antarctica. So he knew the station master, he knew the whaling station, he knew there were people on that island, at least, you know, getting to somewhere between a year and two ago, right? And that can change any time. But that was the closest place he knew there should be people. And so that's a pretty rough stretch of water. 750 miles. So 750 miles is like somewhere between Missoula and Great Falls, Montana from here or something, right? And you're talking, like I said, some of the worst stretch of water in the world, right? They only had a 20-foot lifeboat. So the lifeboat seemed big on the ice and a little in the ocean, right? When they had to pull it, it's big. Now it's really little. And he wasn't even positive there'd be a whaling station still there. The margin for error for hitting that island was almost, you know, it was very, very small. It's 100 by 20 miles, if I understand right. But that's a speck in the ocean, you know, when you're talking about no modern navigation devices. They had a compass, they had a couple other things, and it was stormy. 20-foot boat. And if they missed it, they just missed it. I mean, there's nothing else, you know. That's kind of it. Regular storms were starting to come in. This is April, so you'd be just coming. It'd be kind of late fall in the southern hemisphere, mm-hmm. probably equivalent to October here, right? So he's like, we've got to try it now, or it's another winter, and then we, you know. So coming into fall, maybe, or yeah, mid to late fall, really. So he and five other men left in the lifeboat. And he left 22 men behind with shelter and provisions. They could make it, they could winter. They had enough stuff. As long as they didn't go insane, which is a real possibility. I mean, just zero light for weeks. And he only took 1 month's supply along for the six people, for he and the five men, because by that time, he would have either succeeded or died. Now, you think, okay, that's quite an adventure. He's headed out over that stretch of ocean, but it was absolutely miserable. Of course, I'm sure they left and it was nice. But day five, a gale hit them. And this is an Antarctic gale. And they had to chip layers of ice, keep their boat light enough, by chipping the layers of ice off the boat. Some of their equipment got drenched and froze solid. It was too heavy, they had to throw it over. And they were constantly wet and frostbitten. It was bad. And they're trying to hit an island in the middle of the ocean. So the storm cleared up after about 2 days. But again, on day 11, they're hit with another storm. Same deal. And on day 14, I don't know that they were still in a storm, but it wasn't great weather. Day 14, they spotted the island. They found it. But they couldn't find a place to land. So they had to spend another night out in the ocean. And finally, the next day, they did find a landing spot. They landed on the island. They made it. Now, at that point, their boat was leaking. Their rudder was damaged. They were done. They were done sailing. So that was the fortunate part. They made it. The unfortunate part is what seemed like a small island was now big, right? 100 by 20. And they were on the wrong side of the island. And there was a mountain range in between them and the other side, and they couldn't sail the boat anymore. So three of the men were too weak to even leave the site. And they were dying. So Shackleton took the two men that could still sort of straggle out of camp. And he took 3 days' provisions for the three of them, and they took off inland. And so the mountain range is about a 5,000-foot mountain range, and so they're doing this on foot. They had wooden shoes, as I understand it, so they put screws through so they could have a little bit of traction. And they went up in, took their compass, went up into the mountains, and lost their way, had to retrace, basically spent a whole day retracing their steps. Finally, say, hey, let's like head downhill, And they did, but then they had like a 2,000-foot glacier they had to get across. Big and waterfall and all sorts of things. But they did finally make it across the island. And they were in really, really bad shape. And the first people they ran into was a group of children out playing. Now you can imagine, if you're a little village and you're the only people on the island, and these frostbitten, malnourished people come out of the mountains and ask by name for the station master. the children just ran off. They're terrified, But they made it into the village, found the station master, and the station master didn't recognize Shackleton at all. But they finally figured out who he was. And so the next day, they were able to take a whaling boat around the island. They had the whaling station still there. They had a village, gave them food. They were able to take a whaling boat around the island, pick up the other three men. So that was just 1 day extra for them. They were safe. But the 22 men on Elephant Island were still there, and it's coming into winter. And all they had was whaling boats which aren't the best ice navigating boats. He had an ice navigating boat and got stuck, right? So, the other problem is that World War I had started. So the British didn't just have boats laying around that could just go to the Antarctic to pick up 22 people that were stupid enough to get there in the first place. So he tried, I believe, 4 times to reach him with a whaling boat and could not make it. Would hit a wall of ice and had to turn around. So finally, the Chile government let him have a little tugboat. And so this would have been in August. So this was winter. And this is winter in Antarctica. He, over 4 months after Shackleton left him, and the 22 men are sitting around. It was a nice day. It was a clear day. And there's pictures of this. There was a guy along with a camera that documented this whole thing. It's really fascinating. And he has a picture, you know, the tugboat coming in. It's a nice, beautiful day in the middle of the winter. And they're sitting down. And I guess it would have been, you know, you're a couple months past June. So there'd be some light. It showed up in the light. And I guess, I mean, they would be clear up here about 55. So it's not going to probably ever be completely dark. Anyways, they'd get really short days. Well, no, they were back here. I'm not exactly sure where. But nevertheless, they were sitting down ready to eat some more penguin and stewed seal and ready for dinner. And here's a little tugboat coming in. And it was Ernest Shackleton himself driving the tugboat. And he came in and he picked up all 22 men. So they started out with, you know, it started out with 22 and 6 and, you know, 28. All of his men were safely back on an inhabited island. Now, there's a few details left out that we'll get to. But what are some lessons from that journey? So leadership lessons. You need to have a goal, right? Ernest Shackleton had a goal, and it was a pretty lofty one, but he had it, right? And that was to make it the whole way across Antarctica. So that's the first thing. Let's have a goal. Second thing is make the appropriate preparations. Shackleton asked people to follow. But he did. It was truthful advertising. When he asked for people to come with him, he let them know there's a good chance you're not coming back. If we're successful, you might be famous. You know, and if we're not, you're dead. So that was basically how he advertised it. He had lofty aspirations, but he was prepared with appropriate planning and supplies. He just got stuck in some bad weather, basically. He'd done his homework, it looks like. He'd learned some things from the explorers that were successful, not successful in Antarctica. And then the third thing is, be willing to change your definition of success and your focus. So, you look at this, and his definition of success changed multiple times here, right? So initially, his focus and his definition of success was making it the whole way across Antarctica. Well, when he got stuck in the ice, the dream was still there. Maybe they could, you know. But his focus at that point, his immediate focus, was to save his ship. If he get his ship out and his men and everything's still intact, that's going to be pretty successful, right? Mm-hmm. When they spent months on the ice, success became the sanity of his sailors beyond just his saving his ship. He knew how important it was that people stayed sane out on the ice. He went out and they scraped out a soccer field and played. He had soccer matches set up on the sea ice. Right? They took group pictures by the ship, and they every day had a crew of people that scrubbed the floors of the ship. Probably everybody except Shackleton himself had to take a turn. They played chess. They had night watches. They had a structure that had things to do, things to put their minds to, games, organized activities. They had a feast to celebrate the shortest day of the year. Then his ship sank, right? You're not going to, you know, okay, now there's no, he's not saving his ship anymore. Certainly not going across Antarctica anymore. Success now was safely getting to land, keeping his guy safe. The dogs, who were originally access to his goal, right, became food to survive. They did make it safely to land, but even then, success at that point was safely reaching civilization. And when he did make it to civilization, his success was determined by his ability to rescue his men. So Shackleton, by the standard of his original goal, failed miserably, right? But he's remembered as one of the greatest leaders and explorers. Almost an unparalleled leader. And his men spoke very highly of him, which is not the case about all of those explorers, including Scott. He said some pretty sharp things written in people's journals about him. So, his success in returning his entire crew safely home was an amazing, nearly impossible feat. So now do we say, was he successful? What's your measure of success? And are you willing to change your definition of success? So, what are some lessons if we bring that to our school boards today? So I would challenge us as school boards to have a vision and to have goals. So if you think about if you are a business owner or something like that, you know, you should have a vision and you should have a mission statement. You should have goals, right? Why shouldn't we do that with our school? We should have, you know, what would a vision look like? What would a mission statement look like for a school? Anybody have any input on what a board's vision for a school might look like? Okay, a vision, you're going to persevere even when things are tough. And it can be a real general vision or a little bit more. Any other thoughts? You can jump in anytime.
The tendency might be to, and this is the opposite of what you said maybe, but to just make sure you're keeping the teachers happy and hope everybody's going to school and nobody's saying anything. Maybe that's the opposite of the desire.
Yep. It's very good. So sort of a almost not a vision, right? I mean, just sort of, let's see if we can autopilot this thing and not make too many waves.
I guess that could be a bad vision. Maybe that'd be okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Another way of saying that, maybe that long-term value is way more important than short-term comfort.
Long-term value is more important than short-term comfort. Yep, that's a good way of putting it.
Don't just be there for the beginning of the year. Try to be there all the way through.
Show up at the end at least, too, right?
Yeah.
was being articulated in some of the other topics in the general session, we're not just teaching academics. We're trying to teach children how to, well, we're trying to develop character. We're trying to develop community builders, kingdom builders.
Develop community builders and kingdom builders. Yep.
Years of being part of the church community, and then what did they learn at school? How does that
really
wrap
important
into the church?
So I think, you know, it's it's easy, and different schools do it different ways, and it's easy to, you know, you kind of roll through maybe a 3-year term, maybe you're out, maybe you're in like, you know, 20 years in a row, maybe it's and so this is not just for when you're a school board member, right? We should have a vision as a church, as board members, as parents, as teachers, as, you know, we should have a vision for our school. And I think what can be difficult about it is, you know, we're second, third, maybe even fourth generation away from that initial vision. And it's, vision is a difficult thing to pass along. Right? You can pass along the structure. You can say, this is how you do it. This is why we do it. But vision is difficult. You have to get the vision on your own, really. And I think a school board should have a keen vision for our schools. They should understand and appreciate the value of our Christian schools. And maybe this is gained partly by understanding the alternative sometimes, right? And so, you know, a lot of... has anybody in here gone to public school? You did? What grades did you go to?
Only went to the third grade and fourth.
Okay, third grade, yep. So, you know, like, my dad would have even finished out school in public school. I think he went maybe 9th and 10th and then went 11th and 12th to public school. It's a different deal. And even at that point, it was really important to have our own schools. It's even more so now. Our oldest daughter is in the public school system. So we got 3 foster children, and you know, you kind of just send them where you have to send them, which is uncomfortable. And initially we did. Eventually we just we didn't. But so initially it's Head Start, which isn't exactly public. There's some, I forget, Methodist or somebody that had to, you know, program. And she went to kindergarten in public school. We were really fortunate. And kindergarten, this was 4 days a week, like 8:30 to 3:30. It was ridiculous. And big days, and 4 days a week. Basically first grade stuff. And so it was in Harrisburg. Not a big school, not a big city school. We had, you know, the teacher was a, got her degree from a Christian college, and she was a very, very nice person. But it was the public school system still. We were really fortunate. In that school, they have a good elementary school and a decent high school. People pull their children out of middle school and try to do something else and send them back for high school. Pretty rough. But they're kind of known to actually have a pretty decent elementary. So we were pretty fortunate there. But there's just, when we were able to send her here, it was a huge relief. So we'd go to you know, the programs and some of that stuff, and kind of understanding the alternative is you know, that can be a vision builder. Right. So what about goals? What goals should we have for our school? And sometimes, you know, vision and the goals you have, you know, they run together a little bit, right? Vision's a little broader picture, maybe. And then you have goals. Anybody have anything else to add there? I have a couple things down here.
I think it's important for every generation to go back and think what we're trying to do. What is the goal that we're trying to do with our students? What do they need to know? Because if we don't force it, we don't do it. I guess basically it feels like to me, even in the 50s or 60s when they started doing private schools, they did it because of the pollution. They didn't really have that second part of the vision of what are we trying to teach our children.
Here's what we don't want to do, but yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because of the crud that was, you know, influence and stuff. still missing what we should be trying to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So maybe the initial vision was had to do with the dangers and what we didn't want, and now saying each generation should stop and think, well, what are we trying to do here? What are our goals? What is our, yep.
So I agree with what Jonathan was saying here. We should use this as a time to start preparing the kingdom for the Lord's sharing. And if it's our vision and a part of our statement, it's just easier to do.
If you have something stated, you can. Yeah, here's what we're about. Yep.
Well, along with that, I got some staying this class this morning. Some people said we'll get in there and visit and get them there. That's sort of the school board. Well, if you're doing that and you're interacting with the students, then they're going to see that, hey, that's what a school board does. And some of those students will someday be a school board. And they're remembering, was that school board there or were they not there? I mean, when they're. So, yeah, we really teach them.
Taking.
By just getting there and being an example.
Taking subconscious mental notes. Yeah, that's exactly right. So, I think, you know, when I think of this, I think we should help provide a godly framework. Now, these are Christian day schools. These are not Christian schools in the sense of the people. You know, there are some Christians here. There are a lot that aren't. Some of them are too young, right? But the fact of the matter is we've got some pagans in the school, right? But we need to provide a godly framework. We should do our best to hire Christian leaders for teachers. And a leader doesn't have to be full of charisma and outgoing, right? There's different ways to lead. But being a godly example is a big thing. And then we should do our best to support our teachers as much as possible. The fact is that most individuals with enough resistance, without enough backing, will fail at some point. And we should provide a good education for our students. We shouldn't look down on being well educated. We don't need to be highly educated necessarily, but we should have a good education. And so that is the vision, the goals. Now, making appropriate preparations for that. Some of these all tie together, kind of. And so, you know, what kind of preparations can we help make? And again, this should be broader than just the school board. But since that's who's here and kind of in the focus, and that's who we're talking to, right? Basic things, like, you know, and this is maybe a whole church or community depending how your school's set up. You know, you really need to have a functioning school building with supplies at work, right? I mean, that's part of the deal. Another thing is you should have a thoughtfully reviewed curriculum. And that doesn't mean you're going to end up at the same place as the next school that's thoughtfully reviewing curriculum, right? You're going to end up different places, and that's okay. There's more than one right way. But it should be a thoughtful process. Interview and familiarize yourself with the teachers. And then engage as much as you can, engage the whole church in things like PTA and programs and maybe even a evening event with the school, invite the church. It should be, the school should be exciting for more people than just parents and school board. It's really, really vital to the whole church and community. Anything else, anybody? Preparations or some of the practical things you can think of.
Would you have some ideas on what to do for a PTA, typical PTA? I'm just wondering what it is.
Well, that's good. We could take a poll here. Or just, what is what are some good ideas for typical PTA? You know, a lot, I just say a lot of times ours are really pretty low key. I mean, we'll maybe have a speaker, might be somebody from our church, might be somebody we invite in, it might be 15 minutes, it might be 20, you know, and have a snack and coffee, everybody can mingle, and basically, like I say, ours is pretty low key and not that structured. They have time for the, you know, huge classrooms. Teachers are basically in the rooms and parents come by, look at the children's desk, talk to the teacher. We have never set up, like, you know, specific interview times, and that's a, I mean, that could be a good thing. But what are some other ways people do it, or other ideas?
So we do the specific interview times. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to be with Alan personally.
Yeah, no.
And that's what's working in our community. Another thing that can be done is reviewing achievement test results. Otherwise, they just become a meaningless function. Like, every 6-year-old came in the left ear, okay, never did that. What
yep.
was the use? And, you know, there's been school committees that have dropped achievement tests because they frankly they didn't understand. You know, everybody knew how to, you know, interpret the story that they told. And that ties back in with goals. If you like Troyer's, whatever, you don't only have the national norms to compare to, you also have schools of our type, that norms tables that he's developing, with which he has, you know, like, what is that, 120,000, 130,000 tests that are making that norms table of schools in similar situations as they're in. I just was reviewing achievement tests on the way down here, kind of one and some that recently. One of my goals would be that our school would be at least 50% pile of the Troyer program. Okay, it might be a little lofty, right? But we want at least have an average school as far as what other conservative communities are achieving academically.
David, you got your next PTA speaker and subject. Is that the 3-minute bell?
Can you call it?
Okay, now I'll turn. Anybody have his number? That was a 3-minute bell, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just going to buzz through some of this real quickly. Then, be willing and ready to change your definition of success, right? And I was hoping to have a little discussion. We ran out of time, right? What if you have a child with autism? What's your definition of success? And that might have to do with, you know, a lot, talking with the teacher, the parent, that's messy. What about if you have a child or children with some other learning disability, dyslexia, dysgraphia, right? Or what if you have somebody that's just really lazy? I mean, that happens too. What about if you have a high schooler that cheated for so long in a subject that he cannot recover from before graduation? What's your definition of success, right? These are things to think about. You have to change your definition a little bit. What if a student has failed out of his peer group? What's the definition of success for that person? Right. Now, here's just run over some general pointers otherwise that I would, like I said, maybe this is from a teacher's perspective, things I've noticed. Be engaged. And remember that leadership is a bit of a dichotomy, right? So be engaged in your school, but don't be overbearing. Manage, right? Without micromanaging. You don't need to come in and tell all the teachers how to tweak this or that or the other thing. Probably have a better idea than you actually for the current situation, right? But some big picture things, really helpful, because they can lose sight of the big picture, being in the trenches every day. Show up, but don't get in the way. And some things, just some real practical things I can remember school board members doing. There was one I remember occasionally, he'd bring by pastries for the whole school at first recess on Friday, right? Just twice a year, maybe. Just a neat, not everybody can do that. Not everybody has a schedule that allows for that, right? But show up when you can. You know, maybe you could bring the teachers, something after school. It's coffee or, you know, here, definitely coffee. Come and, you know, you can, here again, might depend on your age and and flexibility and coordination and everything. But, you know, you can come play with the students. If you fall over and make a fool out of yourself, they'll remember it, and they'll enjoy it and like it and like you, and it's good. I remember, yeah. Be a listening, empathetic ear, and help, you know, help come up with good solutions when you can. And remember to pray for the teachers and the whole school. You know, prayer meeting, public prayer, you know, those things are meaningful to people. And I remember one, you know, chairman that would ask, how do you think we should do this? You know, that communication, just especially between chairman and principal, is really, really nice. Instead of saying, hey, here's what we're doing. And another thing that has happened that was really nice, offering the spearhead and activity with the school so the teachers can be involved but not have, you know, have a break. So have an evening, invite the church, the school, have the students build things, do things, and the teachers don't have to set up or take down. That's pretty neat. So as a board, be leaders, have a vision, have goals. Be a buffer between parents and teachers if you need to be. Hopefully you don't, but sometimes you do. And you are often the unsung and unpaid heroes of the school. So God bless.